Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
El Paso, thank you very much.
And at last, here I am on the hill overlooking El Paso. I can see Rosa's Cantina below.
Walls save lives. Walls save tremendous numbers of lives.
Walls do not save lives. Walls end lives.
Murders, murders, murders. Killings, murders.
We saw in El Paso, where there was high traffic of illegal crossings, we built a wall and the crossings plummeted.
El Paso has been the safest city in the United States of America, safe long before a wall was built here. In fact, a little less safe after that wall was built.
Plans for a smart, strategic, see-through steel barrier or wall. Let's go on a wall.
Stop the human traffickers, stop the drug traffickers, and build the wall.
We want to build it fast.
We stand for America, and we stand against walls.
Because walls are not immoral, as it was said.
We are a city of immigrants.
They said that progress is being made with this committee. Just so you know, we're building the wall anyway.
Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Arun Roth, sitting in for Tanzina this week. Lots of talk last night in El Paso, where the president, along with Senator Ted Cruz, held a political rally across town from Democrat Beto O'Rourke. But the real action was going on in D.C. With the Friday deadline looming, lawmakers in Washington say they've reached a tentative budget deal that would keep the government funded through the end of September. Once the deal is finalized, it still needs to pass the House and the Senate and get a sign-off from President Trump. One potential sticking point for that presidential signature, the deal only puts about $1.4 billion towards building barriers along the U.S.-Mexico border. That's significantly lower than the $5.7 billion the president demanded for the border wall during the 35-day-long partial government shutdown. For the latest on the ongoing budget negotiations, we turn now to Damian Poletta, White House economic policy reporter for The Washington Post. Damian, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So we have to stipulate again, this is a tentative deal. We'll use quotation fingers, put an asterisk by it. But walk us through what we know right now. What exactly would that $1.4 billion I just mentioned be allocated for?
Sure. So it would be allowed, it could be used to build new wall barrier type structures along the Mexico border, you know, focused in the Rio Grande section of Texas. But it would essentially fund about 55 miles of border wall. Now, President Trump wanted, you know, close to $6 billion that he thought could get him close to 250 miles of border wall. So this, you know, is much less than he had requested, but it does allow them to actually start building new wall, which is something the White House had struggled for 2 years to get Congress to approve so far.
And what they're building, you know, it could be a wall or something else, sort of depending on where you stand on this.
Right. I think exactly. Now, it's not going to be a huge, you know, cement or concrete wall. It's probably going to be the steel slat type structure that it already exists in a lot of parts of the border. But right, it would be, you know, a large barrier to prevent people and vehicles from crossing from Mexico into the United States. Now, obviously, it's a 2,000-mile border. There's already, you know, 600 or 700 miles of barrier. This would be another 55 miles. So, you know, it could be substantial in the area where it's put, but it's not going to, you know, in any way seal off the border completely between the United States and Mexico.
A major point of contention in these negotiations, going up the last few days, has been the number of beds that Immigration and Customs Enforcement can have in its detention centers. First, explain why that was such a sticking point and how did they find a way to work around it?
Right. I mean, this issue kind of snuck up on a lot of us because we'd all been fixated on the dollar amount that was going to be allocated for constructing a wall. But it really flared up, you know, Saturday and Sunday. The Republicans in the White House wanted a lot of flexibility to detain essentially as many people as they thought necessary who were in the United States illegally, you know, including people with, you know, charged with crimes, people who were charged with misdemeanors, et cetera. And Democrats felt like the way that the language was being constructed, it would give the White House and Republicans the ability to detain almost a limitless number of people, as many people as they wanted indefinitely. You know, so the White House could essentially just round up undocumented workers if they felt like it. And so there was this big fight over how exactly this language could be used. I think Democrats tried to put their foot down on Saturday, but by Monday they felt like they had an understanding with Republicans that the language would be more narrowly tailored. So, you know, I think it was confusing for a lot of people that it became this big issue that could force a government shutdown, but both sides kind of worked it out on Monday and feel like comfortable with the way it would be implemented.
Does a deal have a cap on the number of beds?
It does have a cap, but there is flexibility. You know, it's seen by some as a cap and it's seen by others as a floor. There is some flexibility, though, for the White House in certain situations to hold more people if they feel it's necessary. So I feel like the Democrats felt like in the final product, it could not be abused by the White House. But at the same time, Republicans felt like there was a flexibility there so that there wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't be in a situation where they'd have to let people with criminal, you know, violent criminal records go.
Now, we heard President Trump tell supporters in El Paso that that wall is still going to be built. But since that is not in this deal, what does that mean that Trump is going to turn to that state of emergency option to fund the wall?
Great question. And, you know, really all eyes are on him now. I remember the last government shutdown in December. We got to the Tuesday before the deadline. And everyone thought everything was going to be fine. And then the wheels came off Wednesday night. Right. So there's a lot of things that could still, you know, make this thing not work out. He does believe, and the reason that the White House kind of backed down from their dollar demand on wall money is they feel like they have the flexibility to be able to redirect existing funds to create, you know, more potentially hundreds of miles of wall along the border. Now, if they can do that legally, you know, no one's really sure. The White House feels like they can. One option for them that they've been studying closely is to declare a national emergency along the Mexico border and therefore redirect money from, you know, military projects and use that to create a wall. Now, it might be a little tricky if they say, on the one hand, they're signing a bipartisan bill that does allow them to build 55 miles of new wall, and at the same time, it's an emergency and, you know, they need more money. That might be kind of tricky for them. We're not really sure how that's going to work. I'm sure the White House is looking at that and what precedent there might be now as they decide whether or not they're going to support this final deal.
Damian Paletta is the White House economic policy reporter for The Washington Post. Damian, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, switching gears to education now. 2018 was the year of the teacher strike. From West Virginia to Oklahoma to Arizona and beyond, teachers across the country hit the picket lines to protest for better pay, better conditions, and more resources for students. Now, 2019 seems to be continuing the trend, with the latest strike coming out of Denver. Monday was the first day of a teacher strike in Denver, Colorado, with educators demanding a change to the way teachers are paid by the county. Melanie Asmar is a reporter with the Chalkbeat Colorado, based in Denver, and is covering these strikes. Melanie, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, what are the immediate demands of the Denver teachers?
Yeah, the Denver teachers want basically a new pay structure as well as higher pay. Denver has merit pay for teachers. So essentially, teachers get a base salary and then bonuses and incentives on top of that base salary, you know, for things like working in, say, a high poverty school. But they say those bonuses make their pay really unpredictable. Like, they could get the bonus one year and the next year they could not get it. And so they want to move back to a more sort of traditional way of paying teachers. And they also want higher salaries.
And so that's what the teachers are objecting to, this pay system.
Yes. Yeah. It was pretty revolutionary when it started in Denver in 2005. And sort of what made it so revolutionary was that it had the support of the teachers union. Unions usually oppose merit pay. But in Denver, they were willing to try this experiment. And voters actually passed a new tax to fund it. But after, you know, the past 13 years, teachers say it's not working. This variable pay is driving them out of the district. And Denver has gotten more and more expensive. And teachers say their pay isn't keeping up.
Can you describe the scene at the schools throughout the city? Are students still required to attend?
Yes, yeah. All schools are actually open. They did cancel preschools that the district runs, but all schools were open yesterday, and they're also going to be open today. What it looked like, I was at the city's biggest high school yesterday morning. It looked like, you know, a big crowd of teachers wearing red jackets, red. It was quite cold here, so they were bundled up all in red, marching with signs and chanting kind of in front of the school in a circle. Students were streaming in at around, you know, 7:30, and then at around 9, a bunch of students streamed back out saying that, you know, it was kind of chaotic in the school and there weren't enough substitutes, they were saying, and they were all kind of like grouped in the auditorium or the gym, and they had these sort of modified schedules, and a bunch of students ended up walking out, and that happened at a lot of high schools around the city. The high school I was at, some students joined the picket line. Some students had made cookies and other snacks for the teachers, and they were handing them out. I did see other students just sort of walking off campus. But yeah, there were students at all the rallies and things like that yesterday.
Do you have any idea how much this is costing the school district to keep schools open during the strike?
Yeah, they have said it costs about $400,000 a day, but they're basically funding all the substitutes, and they made these sort of prepackaged lesson plans, and they're funding all that with the money they're not paying teachers. So the teachers who are on the picket line who are striking are not being paid.
What's been the reaction so far of the school district officials? Is there any sign of them budging on this?
Yeah, they are headed back to the negotiating table. You know, they've been negotiating for 15 months. They were at it over the weekend again, trying, you know, to avert this strike. The last bargaining session on Saturday did not end well. The district came out with a new proposal and the union rejected it. The lead negotiator kind of stood up and snapped his laptop shut and said, you know, we'll see you on Tuesday, meaning they were going to strike Monday. So
we mentioned at the top there have been these strikes across the country. Can you tell us how this strike is playing into that broader teachers movement that we may be seeing?
Yeah, I think it's most definitely a part of it. I think teachers in Denver have been inspired by teachers in Los Angeles and other places. What makes it different is that it really turns on this issue of merit pay.
Melody Asmar is a reporter with Chalkbeat Colorado based in Denver. Melanie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We continue our look at education in the United States with one teacher who has gone on strike himself and has done a lot of thinking about what educators face in America today. Nate Bowling teaches American government and politics and AP Human Geography to grades 9 and 12 in Tacoma, Washington. He was a 2016 Washington State Teacher of the Year and one of four National Teacher of the Year finalists. The others were Sean Sheehan, Daniel Jose, and Johanna Hayes.
2 weeks ago, I was in Los Angeles. I'm speaking at an education convening, and it hit me that, like, I had been on strike in September. Daniel was in strike in California at that time, and Johanna had just become a member of the House, and Daniel was in D.C. And it really hit me that, like, all four of us had had these, you know, kind of career experiences.
So two of 2016's top teachers have gone on strike, and two have left teaching altogether for D.C., Nate wrote about this on Twitter in a thread that thousands of people engaged with, and he joined us to go even deeper, exploring what these paths tell us about the state of teaching in America.
I think what's happened to the four of us is kind of demonstrative of a two-track problem in teaching. Track one is just that, like, without exception, or with few exceptions, teachers across the country are drastically underpaid, given the skill set that being a teacher requires. And also, frankly, the number of obligations that are put onto our plate has become unsustainable. The second track is about what's happening with highly effective educators. Effective mid-career educators are fleeing the profession, and they're fleeing the profession because the skill set that it takes to be an effective educator translates to a lot of other careers as well. And so I've seen people leave teaching to go be technical writers and project managers, and those jobs are lower stress and actually pay more.
Well, you know, there's a lot of lip service to the importance of education and teachers. How do you explain that we got to this moment for teachers in America?
We pay a lot of lip service in American culture and society about valuing education. But like one of my favorite quotes is from Joe Biden. Joe Biden said, "You can tell me your values, but show me your budget, and that'll show me what you really value." I don't think we actually value educators and education. And I think one of the contributing factors to that is that it's a feminized career. If you look at like similar career fields like social work, nursing, and teaching, it's a career field that's led by women. And there's a bit of like institutional latent sexism in teacher salary. I have the benefit of like working with some really phenomenal women in my profession, but they're underpaid. And I think if the demographics of teaching were different, if the demographics of teaching look like firefighting or like police officers, then the salary issues wouldn't be there like they are.
So what do you think about the response of striking by teachers in the face of not feeling valued, as you say?
Strikes are an extreme response to like what's happening in our school systems, but they're also like a last resort. Listen, like nobody wants to go on strike. Being on strike's a miserable, miserable experience. Like I didn't go to school. I didn't go to grad school. I didn't spend all the time studying so I could walk a picket line. Like walking a picket line is not a pleasant endeavor. You sit there and like you walk back and forth. It's mindless. It's mind numbing. And I've been on strike twice. I haven't enjoyed either one. That said, the reason why people are going on strike is that they don't feel heard. And it's a way to, in order to get the community's attention, in order to get real change.
And I imagine you're following these across the country. What was your reaction to the strikes in Denver that just started?
I think what's happening in Denver is demonstrative of the problems in the teaching profession. Like we have a class of worker and a group of teachers out there who like don't feel heard and feel frustrated. And they're taking to the streets because that's like the only thing that they have left. I feel that far too often teachers aren't engaged in the policymaking process or in policymaking conversations. And so one of the ways in which you can get heard is withdraw your labor. And that's what teachers are doing in Denver.
And what to make of the fact that these are happening? It's hard to imagine places more different than Chicago and Denver. You know, I'm trying to figure out like what pulls us all together.
You're exactly right. If you look at the places across the country where strikes have happened, in Oakland, in Chicago, here in Tacoma, in Los Angeles, and those strikes that happened last year, like in West Virginia, like these are very, very different places. But across the country, teachers are really frustrated. And the thing is like this is teaching is a really important job. I'm going to argue, and I often argue, it's probably the most important job in our society. But like we aren't as a system and we aren't as a country meeting the needs of our educators.
Do you feel like there's... at least something positive to take away from this narrative that we have teachers that are turning to policy work at least, including one who is now a part of the government, that they might be able to make some of the needed changes.
When I posted that thread, I feel really sad about the condition of the profession, but I also know that like I have a platform in which I can tell and share my story with what's going on. And so I guess like one of the positives is that I hope that this is part of catalyzing a national conversation about what we want from teachers. Like what we've done as a society is we've just put like new obligation, new responsibility, new role, new obligation, new responsibility on teachers' tables, on teachers' plates, and like we haven't given them additional time to do any of it. The job of teacher, particularly at a low-income school, involves being a counselor, being a social worker, and being a surrogate parent. But there's no additional time in our school day and no additional resources or training to do that work. I think about this especially in contrast to the way that teachers are viewed abroad. In 2014 and 15, my wife and I had the opportunity to go and visit China, and we taught actually some summer programs there. And just comparing the way that teachers are revered in other places to the way that teachers are treated like factory workers here in the United States shows a really glaring contrast.
So, Nate, what would keep effective teachers in the classroom? What is it going to take?
I'm reminded of a rap song from the 1990s called Money, Power, and Respect. And like to me, teaching is like a three-legged stool. You can stand still with two of those legs, but you have to have one of them. And so essentially, like teachers are willing to work with below market wages and wages below like what our skill set says we're due. But if we're going to have below market wages, then like we have to feel like we have power over our profession and power over our classroom and the respect of policymakers and school leaders. And if we don't have those two things, then like the wages become a problem. Conversely, like if you have high wages, but you don't feel like you have any power or any respect from the community, it's the same thing. And so like two of those three factors have to be in place. And what we're seeing across the country is basically like those factors aren't in place.
Nate Bowling is the 2016 Washington State Teacher of the Year, National Teacher of the Year finalist, and host of the Nerd Farmer podcast. Nate, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can check out Nate's thread on Twitter about the four Teacher of the Year finalists. You'll also find links to his podcast and other musings. He's at Nate_Bowling. Chaos continues to reign in Virginia as calls grow louder for three top-level state officials to step down. Earlier this month, racist photos emerged from Governor Ralph Northam's medical school yearbook. A few days later, the state's attorney general, Mark Herring, also admitted to wearing blackface as a college student. And last week, two women accused Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax of sexual assault. He maintains his innocence and has called for the FBI to investigate. The question before Democrats, do they stay true to opposing those accused of sexual assault and force out Fairfax, who is black, while the governor and attorney general remain in office? For more on this predicament, I'm joined now by Wes Bellamy, a city councilor in Charlottesville, Virginia. Wes, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So it seems that right now there is a lot of pressure on Lieutenant Governor Fairfax to resign. And in terms of the governor and attorney general, who are both white and have these racist photos that have come up, it seems like the pressure there is dying down a bit. Is that read correct?
No, I would disagree with that. I've been literally talking to people across the state, and it's been very consistent, specifically amongst African-American elected officials and those who I've been in contact with. They are adamant that they want the governor to resign. And it seems as if he's been rather clear that he's not going to resign. So yesterday, I actually proposed a set of different initiatives with a group called the Virginia Black Politicals and about 114 other African-American elected officials and community leaders, requesting a litany of different options for the governor in terms of equity.
I'm sorry, is the idea, though, that he could do these things as compensation and then remain in office, or would you still want him to resign?
In my personal opinion, it's rather clear. He has one of two options. He can either resign, which is what a lot of people want him to do, or he can commit himself 120% to addressing issues of equity by listening. He didn't get to use his privilege to be able to lead this conversation. He doesn't get the privilege or exercise his privilege to be able to say, well, this is what I want. This is what I'm going to do. It needs to come from the people, his constituents here within the Commonwealth. And honestly, he would not have won the election without the African-American vote. So now he has to do everything that he can to make this right, or we're going to continue to call for his resignation and push for him to leave.
Turning to Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, who's been faces these sexual assault accusations, should right. Lieutenant Governor Fairfax resign?
Justin Fairfax, who stated emphatically that he's calling for a federal investigation, he's requested such. I'm a father of three daughters. So it's really important for us to respect women, listen to their stories, give them the opportunity to share their experiences, but also allow for a formal investigation to take place and for there to be due process. So I think that needs to take place first. There needs to be a full and thorough investigation. And Mr. Fairfax is a personal friend of mine, but I mean, I'll be the first to say, as we also put in our letter, that if these allegations are true, then he needs to resign. But there does need to be due process.
If Fairfax ends up being the only one who has to vacate his office, either by force or by choice, while the two white politicians get to continue on, I'm wondering what that could mean for the racial dynamic in Virginia broadly, but also in the Democratic Party there.
It's going to send a very bad precedent throughout the Commonwealth. So, I mean, some people may not want to hear this, but it will confirm many of the theories and the thoughts that whenever these kind of issues come up, it's oftentimes the African-American who has to take the fall for everything. There's two very serious allegations against the lieutenant governor that need to be taken with the utmost, need to be handled rather with the utmost level of respect to those who have accused Mr. Fairfax. But then there's also two situations in which our governor, as well as our attorney general, have admitted to participating in blackface. But we're coming off here in the city in which I govern in 2017, white supremacists, members of the KKK, and neo-Nazis walking up and down the streets of Charlottesville, and they actually killed someone. So, I mean, the legacy of white supremacy in our state is very strong. It's still strong. We're trying to move away from that. We're trying to reconcile, but there can be no reconciliation without us truly acknowledging and dealing with these deep facts. And in my personal opinion, also, there can be no reconciliation without reallocation of resources and truly having equity throughout our community, specifically for the African American and Indigenous communities.
Well, do you think that, you know, I hate that phrase teaching moment, but do you think that maybe this moment could lead to a bigger reckoning with Virginia's history and the racial past?
I think it will. There's absolutely no doubt about it. It will listen, no one's perfect. It's very well documented. When I was 21, 22, 23, I used to say the craziest and wildest things on Twitter. I was called out on it. My city actually forgave me for it. You know, I've dealt with it. I've grown. I'm 32 now. So I'm not here to say that. I'm a firm believer in the good book. And it says he who is without sin cast the first stone. However, I do think that we have the opportunity here in the Commonwealth to be able to make a strong, strong, strong move towards equity.
Counselor, you mentioned how in the past, you had had some offensive tweets that were apparently homophobic and sexist, and that caused a dust up for you, and then you were forgiven for that. I can imagine some people saying, well, why wouldn't you be more open to forgiving the governor for his youthful indiscretions when it comes to something racist?
So for me, I think it's important to take accountability whenever you mess up. So what he did on the first day, on that Friday, when everything initially came out and he accepted accountability and he took accountability, I was actually one of the ones who was saying, okay, hey, he can live through this. Everyone makes mistakes, just as I have when I was younger. But then at the press conference on that Saturday, for him to make a complete mockery, in my personal opinion, of everything that transpired, talking about doing the moonwalk, talking about putting blackface and shoe polish under his eye, and then essentially pretending as if this is a joke in some regards, it put a really bad taste in my mouth. And not just mine, in the eyes of many people throughout the Commonwealth. When the tweet situation came out with me, I was let everyone in our community know that you all have seen me grow up. I'm obviously not the young man that I used to be, but it's up to you all to forgive me for the things that I've said in the past. And people have done so. Some people have, some people haven't. But when I never made a joke about any of this. So I think it's like, sir, you have to take accountability, own what you did, and apologize. But don't joke. Don't laugh at our pain. That hurts. That hurts seeing that.
Wes Bellamy is a Charlottesville city councilor. Wes, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
May 1975, Cleveland.
A white money order salesman was making his daily rounds at local convenience stores on the east side, which is the predominantly African-American part of Cleveland. And he was coming out of a store, and he was attacked by two men. He had acid thrown in his face. He was hit with a metal pipe and then fatally shot.
So begins the story of one of the longest imprisonments for a wrongful conviction in U.S. history. Three black men were arrested for this crime. All were sent to death row. One served 39 years in prison. Ultimately, all three were released. Their convictions were overturned, but not before losing decades of their lives. Victims of racism running deep in the city of Cleveland. Reporter Kyle Swenson has written a new book about this case called Good Kids, Bad City, a story of race and wrongful conviction in America. I asked him, how did these three men get caught up in the system to begin with?
These three men, Ricky Jackson, Ronnie Bridgman, and his brother Wiley Bridgman, lived right around the corner. It was kind of their corner store that they always went to and shopped at. And that day, they went to the store with the rest of the neighborhood after hearing about this crime and saw the police tape and saw the body under a sheet and then just kind of went about their business and didn't think much more about it until later in the week when at like 5 a.m, Cleveland police officers busted into the Bridgman home and arrested all three of the men. And they were told that they were being arrested and charged with murder for this crime, which they claimed and didn't have anything to do with.
And the charges and ultimately conviction of all three, it was based on the eyewitness testimony of one individual. Could you tell us about him?
Yeah, his name was Edward Vernon. He was 12 years old at the time of the crime. He was the neighborhood paperboy. Kind of everybody knew him. He had big, clunky glasses. He didn't have too many friends, but everyone in the neighborhood knew the Vernon family. They knew Eddie. And he came to police and said that he knew something about the crime. And when these cases went to trial, he was the only witness, he was the only evidence at all linking these men to the crime. And he said that he had seen Ricky, Wiley, and Ronnie commit the crime and then escape in a getaway car.
And all three are convicted. And is this the only evidence against them?
It was the absolute only evidence. There was no physical evidence. There were no other eyewitnesses who could link them to the crime. Basically, these three men were convicted and sent to death row at the time on the basis of just this boy's testimony.
There's a lot of context here you get into this book, because the book is about a lot more than just the details of this crime. You mentioned the races of the individuals involved, that this was a white man who was killed in a black neighborhood. The accused were all black. And it's important that you get into some of the context of the racial history of Cleveland in 1975.
Yeah, Cleveland was very interesting at this time. During the 60s, there had been two major race riots in Cleveland, the one in the Huff neighborhood, and then later the Glenville shootout, which was very remarkable because this happened in 1968, and it was a moment when a group of black militants basically ambushed and opened fire on white police officers. And this was before the Black Panthers really had kind of a national profile. So it was a moment, really, if you're a moderate white American, where the racial tensions in the country have bursted open into open warfare, basically. And this happens on the streets of Cleveland. It's kind of what everybody had worried would happen nationally. And so in Cleveland, there was incredible racial tension. This was also, it's very interesting to point out that Cleveland in 1967 elected Carl Stokes, who was the first black mayor of a major American city, which is really a hallmark moment of the civil rights movement. So you have all these different elements in the city at the time, these factors of race really kind of ratcheting up the tensions, particularly between the white majority white police department and the black community.
And that eyewitness, the 12-year-old or the individual who was 12, ended up coming back and recanting, right?
Yeah. After I published my first story in June 2011, unbeknownst to me really at the time, the Ohio Innocence Project took up the case and kind of redoubled their efforts. And after reading my story, they realized that Ed was the key piece here. And so over time, they reached out to Ed. And also, you know, Ed had become very religious and his pastor knew about this story. I had spoken to his pastor originally. And the pastor understood that there was something wrong here. And so he put quite a lot of gentle, subtle pressure on him over time. And finally, got Ed to admit the truth, which was that he had lied in his testimony in 1975 and that he'd been coerced by Cleveland police detectives into giving this false testimony and that they had fed him these details. What came out in 2014 was that he had originally volunteered to help the police. He thought he was doing the right thing by saying, I might know something. In reality, he didn't know anything at all. But by that point, he had kind of already been grabbed by the police. And eventually what happened, there was a lineup. Wiley and Ricky were placed in a lineup and Ed was shown them and he didn't pick him out of the lineup. And afterwards, the police pulled him into a back room, according to Ed's account, and got very angry. He said the detective was slamming the table, got very kind of violent. And the detective told him that he would arrest Ed's parents for perjury if he didn't go forward with this. And Ed, of course, is 12. He's just a scared kid. He breaks down in tears. He agrees. The detective pulls out a typewriter and takes the statement from him, basically saying, okay, what did you see, Ed? And Ed said, well, I don't know. What did I see? And the cop basically started feeding him details about seeing them attack the man, seeing the getaway car pull away. And what I thought was very interesting about when Ed recanted is that, you know, he had lived in terror, basically, for so many years, and he had developed drug problems as an adult, and he traced that all back to the anxiety and really terror he felt because of this case, anxious about what he had done and fearful that the police would send him to jail for perjury. I mean, he really was terrified, and those became kind of the triggers for his addiction.
What does it take, then, for the other two guys to get freed and for all three of them to have their names cleared?
So the Innocence Project filed in March of 2014, and they filed on behalf of Ricky Jackson's case because Ricky had been in for the longest. And the idea was that if they could topple his conviction, that the other two convictions then would follow suit. And so that kind of teed up this evidentiary hearing, which was scheduled for November 2014. Ed had to go to court and say, no, this is my story. This is true. I lied in 1975, and now I'm trying to tell the truth. And so that is what triggered finally the release of these two men and finally the exoneration of all three of them.
Something that really resonates in this story is this really stark tension between the community and law enforcement. As you mentioned, there are people who knew full well that these guys didn't do it, but there was no communication between them, no feeling like they could actually approach the police. Has that changed in Cleveland? And could you sort of compare then and now?
It hasn't changed in Cleveland at all. I think a great sign of that is that within 48 hours of Ricky Jackson and Wiley Bridgman walking out of the Justice Center in downtown Cleveland, Tamir Rice was gunned down in Cleveland. So I think that shows that those racial tensions are still incredibly alive in both Cleveland, but I mean in all American cities. You have to think about how this is played out nationally. That tension between black communities and their police is really kind of a defining characteristic of American cities today.
That's Kyle Swenson. He's the author of Good Kids, Bad City, which follows three young men in Cleveland who were sentenced to death for a murder they did not commit and exonerated decades later. The book is out today. Kyle, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's all for us today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Roth, sitting in for Tanzina. This is The Takeaway.